The pleasure felt at such acquisitions soon turns luxuries into necessities, which is at least arguable as to wisdom, but also turns sound moral values into false materialistic ones, which is not. The more they yield to the suggestions implanted by their surroundings, the more their hearts fill with desires and become restless. The complexity of modern life, especially modern Western life, has made its victims lose the capacity to discriminate between the merely superfluous and the really indispensable. The meaning of this goala, which has nothing to do with heroic asceticism, must be carefully specified. Desire is the driving force of life. Its manifestation and development within the human entity are part of the evolutionary plan for that entity. It is needed in the early and intermediate stages to bring out various latent capacities. It is needed in the advanced stages where it assumes the forms of personal ambition and cultural aspiration, to bring out still further capacities of a subtler kind. Its place in life is not an evil, much less an accident. During the stages of man's development of the personal ego, his desires for the things which hold it are right and natural. He has to make use of them, attach himself to them, to satisfy needs and fulfill ambitions. But when, during the later stages of his planetary appearance, he discerns that he has not been set down on Earth only to achieve physical improvement and bodily comfort, but also to achieve a higher goal and fulfill a higher destiny, a spiritual realization of the higher and consequently more important purpose of that appearance must complement and modify the lower and preliminary one. Before these things, attachments and desires were useful and necessary to him. After, they are so only to the degree that endless wants are differentiated from essential needs. It is inevitable that a time should come when, with the maturest experience and the ripest reflection on the one hand and the bitterest suffering and keenest disappointment on the other, his desire nature is forced to devaluate its objects and consequently to check its own activities. This does not mean it is to renounce them outwardly, but rather to discipline itself and its attachment to them. A life of simple tastes in and of itself tends to foster inner tranquility. Only by beginning to simplify, can man come back to a more natural existence and consequently a more spiritual and healthier existence. Beyond the degree of real need, things may become hindrances and he may have to begin to withdraw from them. He must examine his life and question his desires, to see how far any of them interfere with the realization of spiritual aspirations or take up time which he requires for exercises in relaxation and meditation. This will inevitably need to be followed by an ascetic readjustment, a learning to do without and to let go. Life is too short to be worth spending in bodily comfort but in spiritual stagnation, if examination reveals such to be his situation. At some point a man has to detach himself from attachments, has to say to things and even persons claiming entry into his heart, thus far and no farther. He can train himself to become inwardly dissociated from relationships without becoming outwardly frosty towards them, to feel inwardly free and detached and not to be owned by things or people is a condition few Occidentals understand, let alone experience. It is not necessarily the things from which he is to separate his heart, but the dominating desires for those things. Such a change of attitude may or may not lead to a casting out of possessions. His inner leading and outer circumstances must determine whether this is necessary. The need to simplify his life by managing with less things may rise within him, or it may not be possible, in view of his station in the world, to do even that. It does not matter. What matters most is what keeps him imprisoned in the ego. The thoughts and feelings expressed and desires that are always demanding more and more and are never satisfied with, or resigned to, what they already have. Property may be left as a chain clanking around his ankles or converted into a power for self-improvement and larger helpfulness. It is not what he owns but how he thinks and feels about what he owns, that really matters. Therefore it is not so much through the outward gesture of renouncing things that he makes genuine spiritual progress as through a change in the inward attitude towards those things. To become detached from the world does not necessarily involve the emotions, although it most often does. One may still feel certain attachments and yet be really detached, provided one acts so in will and deed. Those who talk of sacrifice and detachment but have never had any possessions or position to give up, talk too easily. This is why such opinions as the following are widely and firmly held. I think it an impossibility to obtain philosophic tranquility without riches, and I ridicule the opinions of those philosophers who boast of internal peace, in the midst of penury, and I listen to their assertions with incredulity. These words were written more than a century ago in Italy by the Marquis Francesco Guasco. How could anyone have removed the skeptical nobleman's doubts? No argument is so solid and convincing as that of personal experience. Nothing else can bring a man to believe that those sages and mystics who felt and proclaimed this mental peace, despite their poor external conditions, were neither telling lies nor suffering from delusions. They had found true inner felicity, and the incredulous would be talking better sense if they objected not to its feasibility but to its difficulty. Philosophy teaches that the supreme fact of any man's existence is not his circumstances or his fortune. It is himself. Environments come and go like the tide, the winds of fate and fortune rise and fall resistlessly, but through all change the thought of the I dominates everything. And the primary business of human life is to build character, enlarge knowledge, expand consciousness, and above all recognize itself, its I, as rooted in a higher state of being. Its secondary business is to gain experience. It feels pleasures and pains, acquires money and rears a family really as a means to the primary one. The only peaceful individuals are those who have inwardly withdrawn themes over so and sometimes outwardly too to follow a better way of life, who have refused to submit to an activity which has no higher goal than its own mere self-continuance, who have set up a goal of spiritual attainment inside and outside the goal of physical attainment. The Occidental worker should not be asked to imitate the Oriental fakir and seek the state of utter desirelessness. He wants to live well and so must have some desires. Desire, as already said, has its proper place and usefulness in life. Nevertheless, he should recognize the transitory nature of worldly things, pleasures and possessions, and consequently seek also for that which alone gives durable satisfaction. He should not limit his desires only to those things, pleasures and possessions, but should also add the desire for spiritual attainment, self-improvement and inner peace. Tired of the contradictions inherent in sensuous aims, he should begin also to cultivate supersensuous ones. He should enter on the quest of spiritual self-realization, a quest whose goal is a unique and incomparable state. This alone yields the peace that passeth all desires and that comes from rising above them. Saint John refers to it in 4:14, "Whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst." This cannot be attained, however, unless he lives not only for the real necessities and disciplined enjoyments of the body, but also for the intangible values which cannot be measured by earthly standards. He may rightly appreciate and enjoy owning a radio and an automobile, if he wants to, but he should not become so infatuated with these merely physical appurtenances of living as to mistake their value and place when compared with spiritual things. A suffering and tormented world needs the silent message of this wisdom, yet only a humbled world is likely to listen to it sufficiently. It needs it, yet only if you see that philosophy is not something fit for dreamers only but is adequate to survive all the tests of all experience. A striking lesson of the catastrophic war and chaotic peace is that security and peace must first be found within ourselves. If this is done, we can then carry them with us whatever happens externally. These are anxious and difficult times for which we need an inner support independent of external circumstances. We must ask and get assistance from the divine part of our being, for we need the extra power to be had from higher values and better principles, if we are to pass safely through this difficult period. There is ready at hand an unfailing resource, there is always present a beneficent power. If we believe in the reality, the higher consciousness, the intelligence, and the grace of the over-self, if we believe that these things really exist and are not mere intellectual concepts to play within a game of speculation, then we must also believe that the over-self can help us in our hour of need. To discover whether this is so, we must proceed to make the experiment. We must place our fullest faith in it and make our deepest appeal to it, which must be in deeds as well as prayers. We must turn our face homeward. We must stop looking to, and leaning on, those who are themselves in difficulty, and remember that everything human may fail us in the end, whereas anything divine is forever a rock-like authentic refuge. The best which we seek is within our grasp because the over-self is within ourself. It can hear our sincere prayer and it can grant its benign grace. We must make the effort, therefore, and rely upon our own inherent diviner qualities, our own sacred potentialities and our own mystical selfhood. If we believe that God is greater than man, we must also believe that the spiritual self, which is our link with God, knows all about man. Since our own knowledge of life is admittedly inadequate and imperfect, would it not be wise and sensible to refer our basic problems to this higher being, to the over-self? So long as we act solely upon our own initiative and by our own feeble light, we have only the limited and often deceptive resources of the false outer self to depend on. As soon as we humbly acknowledge this situation and cast ourselves at the feet of the higher power, seeking communion with and guidance by it, we call its great resources to our help. It is needful to be forewarned, however, that the answer to such a call may not come all at once but is often revealed little by little through the months or years, that we may have to wait a while as call after call perseveringly goes out from us. But it is worth waiting for and is indeed the only thing so much worth waiting for in life. Through the adoption of such attitudes we acknowledge the existence of a higher power and invite its help or even protection, during our difficulties. There are hundreds of thousands of soldiers, sailors, eminent civilians who found themselves in dangerous situations where violent death or horrible mutilation seemed highly probable, and who turned to the higher power in prayer or resignation with an earnestness they had never before felt. They knew their helplessness as individuals and discovered what it meant to have faith, hope and trust in the mind behind the universe. Some of them learned during the war for the first time how valuable was the inward support that could be derived from it. Every crisis which shows vividly how miserably small is human understanding, every catastrophe which reveals plainly how pitifully feeble is human strength, is an opportunity to turn in prayerful humility towards the higher self for help and guidance. To those who have looked out over the world and seen only its strife and chaos, philosophic ideas may bring renewed hope and confidence in the eternal sureness of the working out of God's purpose. To those whose lives are full of difficulties and discouragements, they may bring new guidance and help, or at least the faith that there is a divine ordering of the universe. To those who are willing to accept the liberation it offers from fear and hate and other negative qualities, it shows life on earth no longer as a patchwork but as a pattern. To all it affirms that the movement of the human race is, despite appearances to the contrary, an adjustment to good in the end. Although it utters a warning message to the contemporary world, it also proffers upholding thoughts and practical counsel. To the extent that anyone informs himself about its enunciation of the higher laws and keeps within them, to that extent he protects himself. Chapter 12. The Quest. In that higher world of being where the over-self dwells, no evil can penetrate, or passion agitate. We descend from its absolute goodness to the darkness and turmoil, the sinfulness and violence of this earth, as from paradise to purgatory. The tremendous contrast between its moral sublimity and such moral degradation would doom us to perpetual sadness if there were no link between the two. But the link truly exists. Each human being may find out and follow the age-old quest and thus ascend to awareness of his higher self. All people are engaged upon little quests which have trivial or serious objects as their goals. Only the man who has embarked the ship of his life upon the grand quest has nothing less than the fulfillment of God's purpose for him as its goal. When a man wakes up at last to the fact that his life has been an endless struggle with himself and continues to remain so, he may begin to inquire why this should be and what he can do to end it. Such an inquiry will lead him eventually to the quest's gate. There are those who have never formally heard of this mysterious quest but who will nevertheless get some or even much of our meaning, even when they will not be able quickly to consent to its truth or yield directly to its monitions. Yet in another and larger sense, that will be enough. The challenge will have gone forth. One day, whether late or soon, whether in the flesh or out of it, there will surely be remembrance. What it means then is this, that the seeker forestalls the evolutionary processes by doing for himself as quickly as possible what nature will do for other men as slowly as possible. He practices self-sculpture along the lines drawn for him by intuitive guidance and outer revelation until the ideal becomes the actual. He labors at shaping himself, just as a sculptor labors at shaping the rough marble into an expressive statue. He knows the truth of what he has been taught by both intuition and revelation, as well as by the wide oscillations of experience, that the happiness and character, the insight and strength which give life its real values, he himself must create from within. All these qualities already exist though latently, but he had to bring them forth by willed effort. He sees in his wiser moments that he must stop waiting for happiness to come from outside himself, and that if it is really to come, it must come from inside. And he finds that to make this possible he must strive perseveringly with the chaos of contradictory feelings which interpose themselves between him and the ideal. It is clear enough that action expresses thought. It is not so clear that doing is also the completion of being, that what we do is the consequence of what we are. Those who believe that real philosophy is lost in dreams or immersed in abstractions are wrong. It not only asks the question, what is truth, but also how shall I live? And what question could be more practical than that one? The European American is essentially a practical man, and if he finds that a certain teaching is not merely theoretical but also quite applicable to his everyday routine, that it not only gives its adherents an understanding of the inner purpose of life and an uncommon peace, much power over self and some over environment, he is more likely to look favorably upon it. Here, then, is its historic opportunity, for not only is it incomparably superior to all others, but it can particularly encourage, fortify and guide him during these crisis years in whose swirling vortex all mankind are now inexorably caught. The discerning man should need neither bait nor reward to live as he ought to do, for by this his external well-being and internal welfare are both helped, his true happiness built up or extended. Philosophy is not just a theoretical matter. After he becomes acquainted with the principal teachings, its student has to make an effort to apply them in his everyday living. He discovered these truths by the use of intuition and reason. Now he must test them by the scales of experience, emotional and physical alike. To accept them is one thing, to make them work in himself and his life is another. Until they move from his lips into his living, they are only images reflected in a mirror. All this superb discipline, which he must patiently work out, will be devoted to the endeavor to better himself. Of course, if he were to accept the conventional and worldly standards of thought, feeling, morality and conduct, certain problems might not arise for him. But he has set himself a much higher ideal. That he will occasionally fail to live up to it is most probable, for he is human, but he must not accept his failures with smug complacency. On the contrary, he must try to wipe them out by wiping out their inherent causes and unfortunate results. This demands the discipline of self and sometimes even the endurance of emotional pain. Whatever is gained too easily may go too easily. This is true of the worldly pleasures and satisfactions. But the spiritual ones, which come from self-mastery in thought, emotion and body, and after long struggles, efforts and toils, stay and do not pass away. He who stretches out his hands to the glowing peace of the soul, does not stretch them in vain. But he may not feel its warmth at the first movement, nor at the tenth, unless he is willing to work for what he wants. Whoever accepts this knowledge will not need to be told that whether soon or late, whether little by little or by a revolutional spurt, it must manifest itself in a corresponding practical readjustment of life. Out of the hallowed moments of intuition, prayer or contemplation should come active inspiration for living, and out of the studious moments of metaphysical reflection should come right principles for living. In every situation he should try to hold to these principles and apply fundamental truths, and so acting, he will have no cause for after regrets. To find out their higher purpose on earth is one thing, to dedicate their life to that purpose is another, but many people refuse to do that because it seems impossible for them to realize such lofty ideals. The path is long and unfamiliar, its end seems an inaccessible pinnacle, and the obstacles en route plentiful and formidable. As the aspirant gazes at it, his sense of inferiority may well up, he may become discouraged and feel that the journey is beyond his modest strength and short lifetime. He may doubt whether he has enough capacity to climb the upward course which is before him, as Tao Yu in Ming doubted, when he sorrowfully exclaimed 15 centuries ago, "Heaven is beyond my hopes." But such pessimism is too extreme, unwise and unnecessary. Even if he knows that he will most probably never reach the ideal, this ought not to prevent him striving to actualize it. Even if he has no startling attainments to show for all his efforts, even if his advance is so slow as to seem disappointing, at least he has this gratification, that his face is turned towards the correct destination and that his feet are already on the way to salvation. If he finds the right direction and keeps his face towards the goal, he need not get discouraged at the slowness of his progress. Thomas Carlyle wrote in a letter, "Let a man be true in his intentions and his efforts to fulfill them, and the point is gained, whether he succeed or not. All men, by setting a goal, can make some little progress towards it during their lifetime. The benefit and reward attendant upon the advance are not without worth. If they do this, they will have the satisfaction that they can take the worst that may possibly befall them at least measurably better than if they do not. Let those who deem self-betterment as beyond their capacity at least attempt it hesitatingly, step by step, rather than attempt nothing at all. If they will take the first few steps patiently, perseveringly and correctly, they thereby express their interest in the over-self, and the over-self will then express its interest in them. They may be of good cheer. There are still other goals on the way to the highest one. It may well be that few can never reach that, but it is certain that many can get worthwhile benefits by trying to reach it. Even though they may never feel they can stand on the peak of attainment in this incarnation, they may, though only for moments, get into its beautiful atmosphere. Even this is of great worth. Help is the power which persuades a microscopic protoplasmic cell to take its chances in the evolutionary game of life, and lifts it eventually into the form of a huge elephant. It is the mysterious breath of magic which takes a failure and transforms it into a success. It is the incoming breath of a babe and the outgoing breath of a corpse. It is the transfiguring ray of sunlight which redeems the triviality of the meanest existence. It is the last asset of man, but among the best, for he who possesses help finds fresh strength from inner fall and outer failure. Lastly, those who look as from afar off at the quest, who regard its attainments as something they cannot help for, its labors as something beyond their strength and circumstance, may yet profitably study and familiarize themselves with the teachings. If they have faith in the ideas and accept them sincerely, this is not without some present benefit to them, while it lays a foundation in this life for discipleship in some future life. What does spiritual progress mean? Does it mean to have more and more visions, raptures or strange happenings? No. It means that every year a man shall feel more control of himself, more improvement in his character, more watchful of and obedient to his intuitions, more devoted to his higher self. Once he has set up his ideal, the aspirant will be called upon to judge himself from time to time. He knows well enough that he cannot at once fully live up to it, and for aught he knows, he may never in this lifetime ever fully live up to it. Nevertheless, he must present to himself periodically the thought of what needs to be done, for in this way he will help to keep complacency and vanity at a distance. The stretch or even opposition of worldly experience, its trouble and distresses, no less than its joys and attainment, afford a strict test as to how far and how seriously he regards the philosophy of truth as a practical guide in life. Even the first strong wind of unexpected circumstance will do that. The quest mostly wins its way across a long, flat plain, but other times it courses up lofty, difficult mountains. It is not hard to mistake the path or difficult to take a misstep. The traveler may have to pass through states of temptation and struggle, trial and defeat, combat and triumph. He may have to negotiate his way around or over the boulders which are placed at certain stages of his path. He should be prepared to endure recurring disappointments of exaggerated anticipation and to experience inevitable frustrations of premature hopes. If it is asked, how long a time will it take to follow this quest until the goal is attained? The answer can be only that so long as the over-self is only an idea, not known and not experienced every moment of the day, awake or asleep, so long must the quest be followed. To measure this period on a scale of years must necessarily vary with different individuals. They all start from different starting points, from different levels of their present condition. It is not possible to set any period. Men are to be seen advancing for a time, stopping for a time, missing their way for a time and renouncing the quest altogether for a time. Or they move forward slowly at some periods and quickly at others. So much is asked of them that it is understandable why so few do realize the goal. Man brings into incarnation a number of subconscious as well as conscious driving urges, but they do not make their appearance all at once. They begin to influence him at different ages, so that his character, intentions and actions seldom follow a single line throughout the course of his years. It is in middle life that the buried spiritual aspirations of those past embodiments, as well as of early manhood, reappear and demand satisfaction. Consequently, a large number of aspirants for the quest are drawn from the ranks of those who have reached or passed 40 or 50 years of age. It is often true that the man in middle life may be filled with poignant regrets that he has started on this quest too late to make much difference in his experience, too late to hope for successful accomplishment, too late to have the strength needed for creation of new habits of thought and action. The sadness of frustration may settle upon him. Nevertheless, he ought to recognize that middle age has also brought him some valuable qualities which he did not possess before. It has brought him some equilibrium between passion and reason, between emotions and thought, between body and mind, and between ideals and realities. It has brought him wiser discrimination in dealing with ideas, attitudes, people, events and environment. It has brought him an all-round revision of values and experience, a habit of taking second thoughts and a clearer recognition of the dreamlike, and therefore the mentalist, nature of existence itself. All this will help him in the quest. Few young men have it. If he has no adolescent enthusiasms, no juvenile excitements, no hysteric infatuations, it is only because they are replaced by something better, a calm appreciations, fair, sane and balanced admirations. With age, the passions lose their strength in ordinary men or submit better to discipline in aspiring ones. This change comes as a tragedy to the former, but as a relief to the latter. The Jesuits do not trust a man with full membership of their order and consequently with the knowledge, power and responsibility that go with it until he is 45 years of age. There still remains the beneficent but mysterious factor of the over-self's grace, which no symbol can adequately represent. Its operations are unpredictable, but its factuality is certain. By effort of the right kind, along with prayer and service, it is possible to invoke this grace. Thus, it is not alone upon his personal strength that he has to rely. He may receive inspiration and assistance to do what he could not do otherwise, if only he will look in the right quarter for them. Lastly, if he has been lucky enough to give his mental allegiance to someone who has himself closely approached or successfully realized the over-self, but who has not lost his compassion for others in the process nor shrunk from the sacrifices involved in chaining his feet to humanity's service, the reward then is ultimately sure. The Master's grace will not be withheld when the conditions for its reception become suitable. Wholeness and balance, it is not only part of the quest's goal to make a man wise, disciplined and, in the truest sense, a practical person, but also both a whole and a balanced one. This is indeed highly important. The direction in which life is moving us is the attainment of wholeness of body, mind, feelings and intuition are to become a harmonious channel through which the over-self can express itself unobstructedly. Among those who follow mystical teachings, there is a substantial number who show, by the lack of balance in their character and in the way they conduct their affairs, that they are really psychoneurotic cases.